From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on October 28, 2014, when a 54-year-old man was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Brian LeBlanc had not planned on a life with Alzheimer's so young. Who among us does? Doctors said he had been living with symptoms of Alzheimer's since 2008, before he even turned 50. And when you face this kind of a diagnosis, you might wonder, how could this happen? Well, Brian has become a powerful voice in the conversation about earlier onset Alzheimer's, but also dementia, Alzheimer's, and how to live our best lives with it. He says there are stereotypes about Alzheimer's that aren't always fair. He says living with Alzheimer's is difficult, but doable, and requires a positive attitude and a lot of work. But he is committed to living well. And as an example, Brian has lost his sense of taste and smell, so eating has become a chore. Sometimes he forgets to do it, so he programs his phone to give him alerts on when he needs to have a meal. Well, tonight, the Real Mind film series will show a remarkable film called Alive Inside. And it takes a look at dementia, Alzheimer's, our brains, and music. And let me tell you, having seen the film, it really is amazing stuff. This hour, our conversation will explore themes of the film and broader questions about how we might be approaching Alzheimer's and dementia in the wrong way. How can we do it better? Let's go ahead and introduce our guests. And first of all, on the phone with us is an Alzheimer's patient and the host of This Dementia Life, Brian LeBlanc. Brian, welcome. Thank you for taking the time for us.
Well, thank you for allowing me to be here with you today. I appreciate it.
Very good. Dr. Al Power is here, who is a Schlegel Chair in Aging and Dementia Innovation at the Schlegel U Waterloo Research Institute for Aging, among other titles. What do you usually call yourself, Dr. Power?
I usually call myself Al. And I actually Al, still live here, right in Rochester, where I was born and raised.
I want to know how many times you say you can call me Al.
Well, it's hard to avoid those cliches.
I know. It gets tired. It's great to have you. Thank you for taking the time. And by the way, Dr. Power is in the film that you can see tonight. Robin Lombardo is Northeast Regional Director for Music and Memory and has taught college classes in gerontology for the better part of 3 decades plus now. Thank you for being here. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. Let me be on this wonderful time to share.
You got it. And Robin, do me a favor. Grab that mic. Get it really close to your mouth. And tell me a little bit about, what for our listeners who don't know, what Music and Memory is. Tell us about that.
Well, basically, Music and Memory, we're a nonprofit organization. But what we try to do and what our mission and our goal is to bring personalized music to those that need it the most. You know, we've piloted mostly with individuals with dementia, and we're in almost every setting and every type of diagnosis you can imagine. But we actually help the person become alive. We actually help the person find themselves and create that sovereignty of freedom through the use of their own music. It's really very powerful.
Yeah, you're going to hear a clip in just a second. Tonight, Dr. Power, tell us what's going on tonight.
Well, tonight, the Real Mind film series is going to show the film Alive Inside. There will be some music performed a little bit ahead of that, and then there will be a panel discussion afterwards. So hopefully people can come to the cinema theater and enjoy the movie and then talk to some people, including Robin and myself and others, about what's in the movie.
Cinema Theater, tonight, 6:30 for the musical performance by the Forget-Me-Nots. Love that name. 7 o'clock screening of the film Alive Inside. The Q&A follows. The film is, you know, about 1 hour 15, and let me just, again, I'll tell you, you will probably cry. You will find yourself deeply, deeply moved by this film. I want to listen to a clip, if we could. The film opens with the filmmaker interviewing a woman with dementia, and you're going to hear his questions, and then he introduces some music to her, and you will hear her reaction. Let's listen.
How old are you?
How old am I?
Yeah.
I'm 90 years old.
What was life like when you were a little girl?
God, I've forgotten so much. I've forgotten so much. I'm very sorry. I've been here 90 years. And if I could remember, I would tell you, but I can't remember.
I want you to try and let the music take you back into your memories, to travel back into time. And then we'll stop, and you can tell me where it took you.
Okay.
You ready?
That's Louis Armstrong. Wow. Oh, he's singing When the Saints Go By, Marching By. And it takes me back to my school days.
I would like to hit the number.
My promontories not to go listen to him. We would sneak off at night, bring back pictures from the dance. And I worked in Kings County 9 years, the E-Building in Kings County. My birthday, November 20th, 1920. I was in the wartime. I was working at Fort Jackson. And my son, on February the 4th, was 69. I didn't know I could talk so much.
Amazing. So, Robin Lombardo, I want to start with you here. Here's a woman saying, I can't remember my age. I can't remember so much. And all of a sudden, Louis Armstrong comes on, and within minutes, she's telling details of her life down to the day, rattling them off. Is this a fair representation of what can happen for people?
Absolutely. This is what we see a majority of the time.
Majority?
Yes. Yes, sir.
That's a big word.
Mm-hmm. And what's really unique about this is we have a lot of research and some really wonderful brand new research, especially out of the University of Utah, for example, where they're actually demonstrating how the brain fires after personalized music is played and how it enhances function and the most difficult functions too, like functions that have to do with not being able to talk or not being able to communicate or not being able to organize their thoughts in a meaningful way. To perform daily tasks.
Do we know why? I mean, so this is what someone with no medical training or expertise at all is going to start assuming. So someone like me, who knows next to nothing about the science of this, will assume that Alzheimer's and dementia, and we're going to talk to Brian about his experience, and we'll talk about, you know, sort of the slow creep of what happens inside our brains. My assumption is, well, certain connections start to either get blocked or break down, or I don't know if plaques form or whatever, but music is doing something to either reconnect or prevent that breakdown. I don't know how. Is that generally true?
Well, what we're seeing through this wonderful research that we're actually able to share now is that, you know, the brain itself, when a neuron is died, it's died. Okay. But then we have neurons that can create new connections up until time of death. And we used to think that the brain would fail.
So the neurons that have died have died. But there can be new connections created?
Around the damaged areas, sort of like a new bridge, a new connection. You can grow pathways. And we used to think that the younger person, you know, at age 14, well, whatever you have cerebrally. Well, now we know for a fact that that's not true. With the new functional MRIs, which we didn't have many years ago, what we thought, we now can prove. We can see the firing. We can see the enhanced chemicals. We can see the connections between neuron A and neuron B, which up until this time, this person was not vocal, and now this person's vocal. Or the person has connected with their cultural roots or their cultural music, which no one has found. And they found it, and now we're seeing, wow, this person doesn't have moderate to severe stage dementia. This person actually has mild dementia because they have found their music now, and it's reawakened the brain.
Now, our listeners are going to start wondering, Robin, when this happens, is this just for the duration of one song? Is it for whenever the music is playing, and only then does that sort of spark a fire of brain activity that will last an hour or two or six? Is it permanent? What do we know about that?
Well, we're researching it right now in terms of the best dose, and I'm really excited to use the word dose. But, you know,
because that sounds very medicinal.
Yes, it does.
In this case, which it really is, right?
But we're dosing their music. It's very individualized. It's very difficult to make one statement across the board.
Okay.
It's not uncommon to see it over a period of time, it benefiting the person up to 48 hours, 24 to 48 hours. Mm. But for everyone, it's different. Like for yourself, for instance, you'll say, well, you know what? I like my music right before I go to bed. Or we are finding a wonderful results with a study that's going to be published. Well, we're very proud of this, a music and memory study about swallowing, that one of our organizations tried it with, 10 minutes before dinner. And they had a 72% improvement in overall nutrition and intake. And that, to me, is outstanding. So less weight loss, enhanced swallowing. And that was just because the organization, you know, Columbia Healthcare in Wisconsin, they were amazing. And they tried it, and it worked. It works.
All right, so Dr. Power, we like to say on this program, we're evidence people. Is there enough evidence that we should actually start using the word dose? And is the medical establishment going to recognize this?
Yeah, I'm going to say dose is controversial. I think there are people that say maybe we shouldn't medicalize it too much. Maybe we should just let it be what it is. There are other people that say, well, that's all people are going to respect when we talk that way. So it's a difficult thing. I think I would add to what Robin was saying that the other thing that's happening, I think, is that there are many, and it's great that the show's called Connections, there are many connections in the brain, and some of them are broken with dementia. So when you're asking the woman in the film, for example, what was life like when you were growing up, you're talking about words, you're talking about directly looking for functional memory of something that happened in the past. But there are millions and millions of connections, back doors, side doors, that come through music, through touch, through the arts, that are not accessed just through normal conversation. But then when you bring these in, you're lighting up different parts of the brain and you're bringing other avenues into play that are stimulating these areas that the simple question was not able to access.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to one more clip on the film and then we're going to broaden the discussion about just general approach to Alzheimer's, dementia, how music but so many other factors play in and what we can maybe do better with our families, with our expectations systemically. So there's a lot to talk about there. In this clip from the film Alive Inside, which you can see tonight at the Cinema Theater, Dr. William Thomas works with patients who have Alzheimer's and dementia, and he's familiar with the impact music can have on memory. In the clip you're about to hear, he talks about why music is not used more often.
In today's really crazy system, I can sit down and write out a script for $1,000 a month antidepressant. No problem. Nobody asks any questions. If I want to provide a person with a $40 personal music system, that will take a lot of work because personal music doesn't count as a medical intervention. You see what I'm saying? It's sort of a side thing over here. The real business, trust me, is in the pill bottle.
All right, so I'm going to ask our panelists in the studio first what they think. Robin, what do you make of that clip?
Well, if I was to say to you that I have a music pill that I can give you that can help you and give you the greatest tool to help with the person that you're taking care of, and it would be out in the market, and people would flood it, and people would pay an enormous amount of money to buy it. But we have this. It's not in the form of a pill, but it's there. And it works. Like I said before, it works.
Okay. So we're going to see the medical establishment lined up behind it soon?
But we have a dragon to slay. We have the medical model. It's a dragon because, you know, we have to fix something that's broken. Imagine being able to prevent it from ever needing to be fixed.
Okay. Al, again, I'm wondering what you think about that clip here. It's easy to start getting cynical when you hear that. Do you agree with the doctor's standpoint there?
Bill is a good friend of mine, and we've worked together for over two decades. So, yes, I do agree. And I think this gets to the larger question when you ask why this isn't happening. And it gets to the larger way of the way we framed Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. There's no question that there is brain disease that we have to work on, that we have to research. But we have so medicalized the lives of people with dementia that all we see is brain disease. We don't see the person experiencing the changes. We don't understand them in context. And we start to blame things on disease. So if a person wants to walk like you and I do, it becomes wandering. It becomes exit seeking. It becomes a behavior that must be managed. And everything is relegated to brain disease. And so with that mindset, the only thing that we can possibly do to help people is to come up with a new pill. And so that seems to be the focus. So, I also criticize the biomedical model, and that sometimes angers people. It's not to say that it's wrong, but that it's a very limited, narrow-minded approach that doesn't see the bigger picture. And that has real fallout for people living with dementia when you only focus on deficits and decline in medical illness.
I want to explore that in just a moment here. Remind our listeners that tonight you can see Alive Inside and a musical performance by the Forget-Me-Nots starting at 6:30 at the Cinema Theater. 7 o'clock screening, and then a Q&A following the screening of this remarkable film. That's at the Cinema Theater tonight, 7 o'clock screening. And just got a note from a listener named Paul who says, "This is amazing. When my mother-in-law passed, she only remembered two of her daughters, and this is amazing to hear about this possibility. I'm sure people like Robin hear that all the time, that how come we didn't know about this? Well, that's part of her work, is trying to make sure people understand and can access that. And before we turn to Brian for his story, I want to ask Dr. Power just to tell us a little bit more about what he started to kind of get into, which is that you have occasionally said things that have been kind of controversial. There is a sensitivity in the medical establishment, from what I can tell, when folks like you get pretty critical of approaches in different ways. I think there is a guardedness. PBS had put a special out there. You weren't all that thrilled with it, I think.
Not
fair?
In the least.
Okay, not the least. So generally speaking, what's controversial about your criticism, Al?
I think what's controversial is that people feel that when I criticize our approach, it's that they are somehow bad or they're not doing well. And it's not just medical professionals, but I think sometimes family members are offended if I say we could do better. It's not to say that people are uncaring, but that they are being taught a view that is incomplete. So as I said in that blog post I wrote, they've given the wrong playbook, and they keep failing again and again because they don't have the view that they need. And so my focus has been moving away from brain disease and working on just enhancing different aspects of well-being, aspects of well-being that everybody needs, regardless of age or ethnicity or culture, things like autonomy and meaning and growth and connectedness. And I find that when you use that kind of a proactive strength-based approach, working with people with their existing and emerging skills, you actually get results that just simply mitigating disease doesn't.
I think that the blog post that Al's talking about, we ought to post it, and we will post it on our various platforms, because listeners, if you know anybody, and I'm sure you do, a family member working through dementia, Alzheimer's, if you're thinking about diagnosis, whether it's your own, a parent, anybody, I think Al's lengthy blog post, it's lengthy for a reason. I mean, he doesn't want to just compartmentalize into short, easy sound bites. This is complex, but he goes through a number of ways that he thinks that we can do better. You talk about stigma. Tell me about stigma. What are we doing wrong here?
Stigma is huge, and I think that what we're doing, and once again, we want to raise public awareness, and we also want to raise funds. And what we tend to do, both in the medical profession and with our advocacy organizations, is that we use stigma and fear to raise awareness and to raise money. And we do things that frankly frighten people and demonize the disease. But the disease is part of us. It's like, you know, if I develop arthritis, that's my knee. I have an arthritic knee. So if I develop changes in my brain, that's part of who I am. And when we demonize it or treat it like a, like, you know, I said in one
fading
of my posts,
away or...
yeah, people are fading away, the long goodbye, we're actually diminishing and dehumanizing the very people we're supposed to be supporting. And we're actually creating a fear and revulsion, which then tags on to the person. So people are less regarded. And I think Brian will give you some beautiful examples of what's happened to him in his relationships with people when he tells them that he has Alzheimer's.
Yeah, because I want to kind of play off Brian's story with Al. So, Brian, let me bring you in here. Let's talk about your own diagnosis, which I mentioned came in October of 2014. You know, you're not even 60 years old. You started showing symptoms before you were 50. Can you take me through your mindset, what you were learning and trying to understand about yourself when you got a diagnosis at that age?
Well, first of all, I would like to say there are so many things swimming through my head right now as far as what y'all have been talking about. So, but I'll get to that in a little
sure.
bit. As far as the diagnosis process, I'm fourth generation of having this disease. Started with my great grandmother, my maternal grandfather, and my mother, and plus my father had vascular dementia. Not only do I have the genetics for Alzheimer's, I have also something called the APOE4. Al, what is that called?
The gene, the gene allele.
An allele. Yeah, that's it. So I have two copies of those from both my parents. And so I was getting lost while I was driving. When I didn't even know that I was getting lost. Come to find out, I had been lost about 20 times in a six-month period. And the only one that I remembered was the most recent one. So we knew it was time to go get diagnosed. And the diagnosis process in itself was, I guess, for lack of a better term, the most impersonal thing that has ever happened to me. Because not only did they say You know, they came in and gave me the diagnosis after all the testing and so forth. And my doctor just walked in and he started talking about different types of Alzheimer's and different types of this and different types of that, all this medical information. And so I stopped him and I said, now hold on. I said, do I have Alzheimer's? And he says, yes. He says, you have what's called early onset Alzheimer's. Now, I had no idea what early onset Alzheimer's was because of the fact that I knew people in my family that had the disease, but never heard that term. So I asked him, I said, what is that? And he says, it means you're under the age of 65. Those were the last words that he ever spoke to me. He just sat there because I wasn't able to talk for all intents and purposes. I was kind of broke down. And then he said, I'll be right back. And he walked out the room. 5 minutes later, there was a nurse that came in. And she said, here, the doctor wants you to take these prescriptions. One was for Namenda, one was for Aricept. And see you in 6 weeks. That was my diagnosis process. Yes, you have Alzheimer's. It's called early onset. Take these two pills, see you in 6 weeks. Nothing to prepare you for, okay, this is what you may experience. These are some websites that may help you. These are some local organizations that you can go to. There's not even any pamphlets or any type of informational literature out in the lobby. Nothing. You just were given this diagnosis, which is a big, huge punch in the gut. And they send you home and say, hey, good luck with that. Hmm. You know, and that's, you know, that's what Al was talking about. And, you know, I applaud him for every single time he speaks out because of what he's saying is the absolute truth. However, I'm not going to throw all the medical personnel into one bucket because there are some that get it. But for the majority, that's how it all goes down. And all Al is trying to do is, hey, treat these people like people because that's exactly what they are. You know, they're not individuals who can't understand because they can. You know, when I can't remember her name who was talking in the beginning, but you played When the Saints Go Marching In by Louis Armstrong. Now, I spent my first 30 years in New Orleans. Okay, when I started, and I'm a huge Saints fan, so I hear the song When the Saints Come Marching In. I know y'all were thinking about the movie and what the lady's reaction was because I saw that movie, and I'm sitting here recollecting all these thoughts as clear as day of what happened, you know, way back when I first started hearing that music and Louis Armstrong and just the whole growing up period in New Orleans. So I was experiencing my musical therapy in real time, you know, just as I was hearing the music. So it's a wonderful thing.
Talking to Brian LeBlanc, who is an Alzheimer's patient, host of This Dementia Life, which you can find online. And Brian, as much as you have that frustration that you felt like your diagnosis came with so much, I guess the easy blanket word is negativity. You know, Al also writes about the importance of autonomy, decision making, you know, also just the challenge that every time you make a decision or every time you've got something to do, you don't want a medical personnel telling you, well, now you have to go here and now you do this. You want as much autonomy as possible, but you yourself, you know, have learned different ways of coping with that. And I mentioned meals, for example, but give me some other ways that you have tried to maintain as much autonomy as you can.
Well, I tell everybody that I have two girlfriends now. One is named Siri and the other one's name is Alexa. I utilize them to remind me, first of all, to take medication every day. It goes off three times a day. I also have a reminder to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I also have reminders for me to take a bath because without that, I was going days, sometimes more than just a couple, of not remembering.
We lost Brian's connection there. Let's see if we can get it right back here. Brian LeBlanc on the line with us, who is an Alzheimer's patient and host of This Dementia Life. Dr. Power, how did you get introduced to Brian?
I got introduced to Brian through the Dementia Action Alliance, which is an advocacy organization in the U.S., which is unique in that it not only advocates for the rights and well-being of people living with dementia in the U.S., but it is its governance, its education, all aspects of the organization are informed by partners who live with a diagnosis of dementia. So they have an advisory board. They helped plan the conference that was held last year. They participated, including Brian. And it's quite a unique and amazing organization.
And I wanted to let our listeners know as we go throughout this hour, if you want to weigh in with your thoughts, we already heard from Paul talking about his mother-in-law's passing and how by the time of her passing couldn't recognize some of her own daughters, which is sad but not uncommon. But you know, if you've got questions about the impact of music on dementia and Alzheimer's, if you have questions or comments about the system itself and the approach, and what you're hearing from Dr. Power or Brian LeBlanc or Robin Lombardo, who is here with us, you can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Brian's connection's reestablished, and I didn't mean to cut you off there, Brian. So you were telling us about the different, you know, sort of techniques you have for helping yourself throughout the day to remember different things, and why don't you continue on the point you were there?
Right, and I'm sorry, I could hear you guys. I'm not sure what happened to the
no problem at all.
My end, but yeah. Sorry about that. But yeah, I use those devices. I also use Post-it notes to remind myself. But you know, I live by myself. Okay, so I'm the person that I have to rely on now to make sure that I'm doing the things that I'm supposed to do. So if I wake up on, you know, in a really what I call a bad fog, where I can't really make too much sense of anything, one of the first things I do is I ask Alexa to play music, and immediately music fills my apartment, and it starts immediately starts the fog starts lifting, so to speak, and more clarity comes to my mind. But I plan out my day every single day, because if I didn't, it would be just too difficult to think on the fly of what I need to do. So, a visit to the grocery store is there, medication refills, all this kind of stuff is completely planned out, because, that's the only way I'm able to function. But I would like to give, another example of music. I mentioned that my mother passed away with Alzheimer's back in 2015, and that was only 3 months after I received my diagnosis. My sister and I was living I live in Pensacola, Florida, and my family lives in New Orleans. So, but my sister, she said, you know, look, you don't need to see Mom right now in the condition that she's in. She can't communicate. We just need to make her happy and make her comfortable. She said, but everybody else has been here to tell her goodbye. She said, but she seems to be holding on for something. So she says, I'm going to put you on speakerphone. I want you to talk to her. So I said, okay. Well, as a side note, my mother sang in church for 40 years. I sang in church for over 40 years. So I couldn't think of anything better to do than to sing her one of the hymns that was one of my favorites and one of the ones that she remembered. Well, when I started talking to her, her eyes started moving underneath her eyelids. And my sister told me, she goes, she has not shown any activity in days. She said, now her eyes are moving back and forth. They didn't open, but they were, you know, they were moving. And she said, I think she hears you. Keep on talking. So I did. And then I said, and then without telling my sister, I just started singing a hymn by the name of Be Not Afraid. And it talks about, you know, be not afraid, I go before you always. Come follow me, and, you know, so forth. It was wonderful. And her eyes were just going back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, not long after that, she passed away. And so from what I understand, and I'm not a medical professional, but I understand that that the hearing is one of the last things to go. Even if you're in a state that looks like you're not there, like in a comatose state of mind. But I'm going to forever believe that she heard me. And I'm going to make sure that, you know, in my last days, that music is going to be playing for me, you know, when I'm leaving this earth.
Hmm. Talking to Brian LeBlanc and Robin Lombardo, and you hear not only this story, but Brian saying when he wakes up, something that he talks about in some of his videos on YouTube is the fog that he just described, and that sometimes just playing music, if that's the first thing he does in the morning, can help break up some of that fog. Mm-hmm. I suspect this is all too common for you hearing this, mm-hmm. Yes?
Well, Brian, I applaud you. I really do. I think you're really such a source of strength for all of us. So thank you for that story. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't get a call or I don't get a text or I don't get an email from a loved one, a family member, saying, thank you for giving me my mom back. Or a grandchild saying, oh, I used to hate to visit Grandpa. Oh, he doesn't even know my name. And this one organization had a box of splitters in the front. I don't know if anyone knows what splitters are, but we use digital devices. So, And instead of having this angst in visiting their grandparent, now they're like, I can't wait to visit him. I can't wait to talk about the music that Grandma and Grandpa had at their wedding. So we're seeing this transformation of relationships. Music and Memory has embarked upon an amazing intergenerational program. It's run wild in Wisconsin. And we're seeing these younger folks. I did a presentation in Massachusetts where it's a campus. And there's these the young elementary school children, the Rashi School, and there's an ice cream parlor, and they'll sit and have ice cream with an 85-year-old. So this second grader said to me, I have to go see Hazel. I'm thinking it's a second grader. She ends up saying, no, she's 85 years old. She's my best friend. She's my BFF on Facebook. And I'm thinking, wow, that's pretty amazing. So it really does, it transforms communities even. The very last thing to go in the brain is the prefrontal cortex. So the person might not be able to do many functional things, but that's the part of the brain that recognizes music, mimics music, and has an emotional tie to music.
Yeah, and Robin, so for listeners who are thinking about themselves or their families, and they're hearing about the power of music, number one, is it more effective to use headphones, or is it more effective just to have music in sort of your presence?
Okay, well, one thing I will say, the blessing of using the headphones, we don't like the plugs, but the headphones are beautiful.
You don't like the little earbuds.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Okay.
But the beautiful part about the headphones is it takes care of and gets rid of ambient noise. And ambient noise is a very difficult thing for individuals with dementia to work through. They can't filter noise well. So it really creates a sacred space. And that's what I've been told with one of my nurses. Robin, you're creating sacred spaces. I'm not doing it. You're doing it. And the person with the dementia is doing it.
So music helps, but with kind of what we call the can headphones, even better.
Even better.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And is it better if it's specifically from a childhood memory, or, you know, how do you kind of tailor a playlist? Because now I know you got audience members hearing this going, mm-hmm. I want to start creating a playlist, mm-hmm. but what's the most effective?
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely recommend everyone to go on the www.musicandmemory.org. We have a guide on our website.
Do it again, the website?
www.musicandmemory.org. The and is spelled out. We actually have some guides that you can request, and one is, you know, how to create a playlist for your loved one. So we have some, like, guides that can help you find it's the right music. We have an elderly person who called in and said, I'm falling in love with AC/DC. How cool is that?
Hey, if Money Talks helps you, whatever it takes, whatever it takes. And then for our listeners who are hearing this, inspire. They want to take iPods to people in different places and communities. Do you do that?
Well, there's many different things you can do. We have wonderful organizations that do drives to find. You also can go on our website and you can actually download a mailing label and mail it in. That won't cost you anything to mail it in. And let me tell you, these wonderful devices are well used.
All right. I'm late for our only break of the hour, and when we come back, Marianne will take your phone call. We've got some emails to read from our listeners. If you want to call the program with comments or questions as we talk about Alzheimer's, dementia, music, and the best approach that maybe take us in a little bit of a different direction than what we typically see with these kind of diagnoses, you can call the program, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You just heard Robin Lombardo, Northeast Regional Director for Music and Memory. And Dr. Al Power is here with us along with Brian LeBlanc on the phone. Brian is an Alzheimer's patient and host of This Dementia Life. You can meet Robin and Al tonight. You guys both going to be there, right? Tonight, 7 o'clock screening as part of the Real Mind film series, the Cinema Theater Tonight. 7 o'clock, they're showing the film, the remarkable documentary called Alive Inside, and there will be a Q&A following the screening, so it's a great opportunity to expand this discussion tonight. Let's get that only break, and we continue in a moment on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, there have been a lot of conversations about free speech and possible limits on speech. We're not just talking about in the workplace. We're going to talk about hate speech. Many libertarians say there really isn't any such thing as hate speech and that speech is not violence. But others have different views. We will debate it Wednesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get right to your comments, as we got a lot of response on what our listeners are hearing this hour. I'm going to start with Marianne in Rochester. Go ahead, Marianne.
Hi, Evan. It's Marianne Dupre, Harmonica Pete's daughter.
Oh, Harmonica Pete is one of our favorite guests we've ever had on this program. Is he 95 now?
95, yep. His birthday was last month.
Wonderful. And tell us a little bit about why you're calling and thinking about your dad on this issue.
Absolutely. For those that don't know, my dad's a 95-year-old World War II veteran who has played the harmonica all his life, and most of the time he's playing at senior homes or nursing facilities, anywhere like that, and vet hospitals. And what he's finding, and he's talked about this for as long as I can remember, is one of his favorite things is that he'll be playing in a room with people that you've seen them in nursing homes. They wheel them in and their heads are down and they don't make eye contact. They don't talk to anybody. It's just they're really there to be there out of their room, I guess. And he'll start playing. He caters his music to exactly what those people are used to. So his age group, obviously, he plays the old classics from the 40s and things like that. And as he starts playing some of these things, like Meet Me Under the Apple Tree, he'll see response from them, minuscule, but the fingers will move, the feet will move. They'll start mouthing, they're following the song with their lips and things like that. And this is something we've known as kids for years, that it's the biggest. People always ask him how my dad, you know, he doesn't take payment pretty much. And it's like, well, you know, you do this all over, how do you get paid? And that's the story he tells. I sit there with a person in a hospital bed who hasn't talked to anybody in days, and I start playing the music and they start moving their lips, or I see them smile because they hear me and they can relate to this. And it's what his greatest pleasure is, of getting to these kinds of people. And that's his favorite places to play. He does things all over the place and as big events, you know, as you're aware of, but his favorite things are one-on-one and actually making that connection with someone and knowing that he's touched their lives and given them something for that few moments. Mm.
Marianne, will you send a happy birthday his way from us?
I will, absolutely.
Thank you for calling, for sharing the story. Your father's remarkable. I'm sure the whole family is. Thank you, Marianne.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Let me ask Robin Lombardo, based on Marianne's call here, actual performed live music, what kind of impact have we seen with that? Because Pete plays harmonica.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a couple of things here. We're very honored to work with a lot of our wonderful certified and board-certified music therapists, some of whom tell us that, you know, 10 minutes before a music therapy session, it just really, the person who normally doesn't participate, participates fully and completely. So that's
before?
It's hard to explain. But
it's like they're anticipating?
No, when you give the person their music prior to something, it excites the brain. And it actually makes the person become alive, awake, and responsive to what it is they want to do. I mean, if you have somebody who's sitting there and looking and watching, they don't seem to have the threshold skills to get involved, but the music and memory and the personalized music allows them to wake up and actually participate. But, you know, I do want to say that our neuroradiologists are sharing with us some information about the difference between genre-based versus that personalized autobiographical music. The brain lights up with music, but when it's the right music, the brain is on fire.
Okay.
Could I say
please
something?
Please do. Yeah, please do, Brian.
One of the things that I do about, you know, living well and trying to keep positive, I also sing. I've been, you know, I told you I sang in church for over 40 years, but I sing with a small group here in Pensacola, and we go around to senior care facilities. And we do sort of the same thing. We'll come up with a theme. It might be one month we'll do Broadway musicals. Another time we'll do from a different time period and so forth. And it happens exactly like she just said, is that they come in and they're sitting there with their heads down. But then you see the foot start tapping. And then all of a sudden they start clapping their hands. They smiling, and then you see him mouth the words. When she was saying that, I'm saying, "Oh my gosh, it's the same way." And when my friends they say, you know, when I'll post on Facebook of where I'm going and so forth, and they say, "How do you do that?" I said, "Well, how do I do what?" And they said, "Well, you could wind up in one of those facilities. Doesn't kind of make you feel bad?" And I say, "You know what? If I do, I hope somebody like me comes along and sings to me." I said, because if you don't see what it does to these individuals, I said, you will never, ever understand. And this is just another way of, you know, it's not only just listening to recorded music, but the presence of live musicians playing instruments and singing songs to them is so unbelievably therapeutic. Not only them for me, for them, but for me too. You know,
you want to add to that, Robin?
Oh, I too. We're very honored to work with Health and Hospitals Corporation, which is the largest public hospital corporation in the organization in the country. They have 11 hospitals that are music and memory certified, and I had the honor and privilege to see music and memory and personalized music and music being played. Actually, it was just so exciting to watch. And they have their music and memory like 10 minutes prior to, and then they actually bring the instruments in, and it's called the Neighborhood Huddle. And you have to see the staff dancing and doing the conga line with the residents. And it is so hysterical to witness. It's an honor and privilege to be a part of this whole program.
Let me get a little more listener feedback, and then I want to make sure before the hour is up we get back to Dr. Power's essay, which I think was so powerful on this subject. Bobby in Brighton is next. Go ahead, Bobby.
Hello. I just wanted to comment that my memory care doctor, I have Alzheimer's, and several people in my family had it, a grandmother, a grandfather, two or three aunts, et cetera. But my memory care doctor told me that, and my family, that it is a gene. And it not everybody in the same family has the same genome. So that wasn't addressed. And I just wanted to make sure that there might be some conversation about it. I'm fine now. I can drive. I have the gift of gab. I can't get around. I don't know Rochester as well as I did with memory loss, but Okay, that's about it.
Bobby, thank you for that. Dr. Power?
Yeah, the gene that Brian describes, the APOE4, is very active in a small minority of people with Alzheimer's disease. So just a couple percent. There may be other genes that confer a certain degree of risk, but I don't personally think that genetics are an overriding factor in most people. I think for most people it's age, because if you look at the prevalence of dementia with any age group, it just goes up and up and up almost logarithmically. So that's primarily an age-related disease. If you have a close relative with Alzheimer's, it may raise your risk, but it's not a guarantee. It may just be slightly more than someone who doesn't have a relative. So there are some people like Brian who have a very strong genetic component, and that may be the case with Bobby as well. But for most people, it is a lot of things that happen to the body and brain over many years of life, and it's a very complex, and I don't personally think that there's necessarily one cause of Alzheimer's. There may be many things that lead to a final common pathway. And then don't forget that in addition to Alzheimer's, there are many other dementias. There are probably over 100 different causes of dementia.
All right, let me get Rachel in Canandaigua on the phone next. Go ahead, Rachel.
Hi, I hope you can hear me. I'm on Bluetooth. So
Yep.
I think my dad was a little ahead of his time, because when my mother got Alzheimer's in the late 90s and ended up in a facility here, one of the things that drove him crazy as a musician was the fact that everybody would sit in the common room with little or nothing to entertain them. So he decided to get a big boombox, and he had a lot of cassette tapes of big band music from his days, and brought it in. And as other people have discussed, you know, they would react to it and, you know, start moving again. And I wish we had known to, you know, maybe take it into my mom's room later, because it was basically for all the residents to give them some form of entertainment. So she eventually ended up not recognizing either of us. But I think it did improve her quality of life. And also, locally, Phil Marshall, I hope he's listening, he's a musician who works in the hospice field, and I would bet that he's had patients that he plays music to. And he talks about that on Facebook and how it affects them. So I wanted to contribute that.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rachel. Thanks for that phone call. And a lot more discussion is going to happen tonight. One of our listeners just called asking, where's the cinema theater? It's 957 South Clinton. Tonight, 7 p.m. is the screening. There's a 6:30 musical performance and then a 7 o'clock screening of the film Alive Inside. A question and answer following the screening. Dr. Power and Robin Lombardo will be there for that. Let me read an email from a listener named Philip, who said that he says he takes issue with the idea that some doctors are okay, but the majority don't really care or just give a diagnosis and wish you luck. He says, I'm sure your guests don't know the majority of doctors. So how about, while the vast majority of doctors are caring and devoted to their patients' well-being, there are unfortunately some who do not demonstrate the expected level of human interaction that patients deserve. Philip, I think, well, I'm going to let Brian address that in a moment, but I also want to talk to Dr. Power, because Philip's missing the point. Some of the point that Dr. Power makes in his post is about a sort of a systemic approach that you think could be better, right?
I think that's true. And with the specific topic of the diagnosis, I think probably for a person, you know, for a person living with dementia, the meeting with the doctor to have your diagnosis revealed is probably the most important meeting with the doctor you have in your entire life. And unfortunately, traveling the world, I've been to 24 countries and talking to many people living with dementia, unfortunately, the experience of that diagnosis falls short in so many cases. Now, I went to the University of Rochester. You know, I learned the bulk of my outpatient medicine from people like Dr. Tim Quill and Dr. Bill Hall, you know.
Remarkable.
And you know, mentors who taught me. And I just kind of assumed, I guess, with George Engel and the biopsychosocial model in U of R, that everybody got that education. But it's been a bit disillusioning to find that doctors don't all have those interpersonal skills and don't have that. And then, of course, once again, as Philip is right, it's not just a fault of character. It's a fault of systems. And systems that put the focus on time and making certain productivity goals in the course of an hour, if you're on the payroll of a large organization, put doctors at odds with taking the time to share very sensitive and life-altering information in the way it should be done.
All right. And so when you write, Dr. Power, much of what we are taught about caring for people living with dementia does not give us the insights to find durable solutions and can actually make things worse, how?
It can make things worse by, number one, pathologizing people's expressions and emotions. As I said before, we hold people with dementia to a higher emotional standard. You and I can be happy, sad, fearful, frustrated, angry. But if you have the label of dementia, it becomes a behavior, and we have to manage it, and we have to give you a medication for it. And so we have this phrase of behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia, which I have been working with people around the world to try to reject. You'll see it in the media and in the medical articles. I believe that dementia is an enabler of distress, but the root cause is usually much deeper. But by blaming people's actions and words on brain disease, you're actually causing a slippery slope to using ineffective and potentially dangerous medications. And we found that by working on boosting people's well-being and not just labeling these things, we've actually been able to meet people's needs, and we've been able to eliminate those episodes of distress without using any medication at all.
And Brian, I'll let you respond to the email as well. Here, we're down to our last couple of minutes. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, and forgive me if I gave the impression, I mean, I wasn't trying to say anything really negative about any particular person. It's just that the process, I mean, there are two neurologists that I have come to know, Dr. Daniel Ross, who is in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and also Dr. William Hu in Atlanta. These two gentlemen, they go above and beyond with their patients as far as explanations and follow-up care and so forth. I know that everybody is not alike, and I know they're like Al just said about the time constraints. You know, you have a certain amount of time, and you have this patient load that you've got to see, so you can't spend as much time as you want to with your patients, and that's understandable. But like Al said, overall.
Once again, no. Hey Brian, just for us, we lost the connection with Brian. Just
you there?
Oh, there, up, there he is. Gotcha.
Go ahead, make that final point, Brian. We've got about a minute left. Go ahead.
I was just saying, Al brought up that, you know, it's the process that has the breakdown, and once that is realized, I think it'll get better. So,
Brian, thank you. And by the way, Brian's the host of This Dementia Life, which I had a chance to see online. It's easy to find it, and it's really valuable insight on living with dementia, living with Alzheimer's. And Brian, continued with success with that and the rest of your life. Thanks for taking the time for us this hour.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Robin Lombardo and Dr. Power are going to be there tonight at the Cinema Theater for that 7 o'clock screening of Alive Inside. Robin Lombardo, thanks for your expertise and your time this hour. Learned a lot. Really great having you.
Thank you so much. It was an honor.
You got it. And Dr. Al Power, let's continue these conversations. And, you know, Al's just about the nicest guy in Rochester, so he gently nudges me once in a while. Push me harder.
I will. Be happy to come back and talk about this and maybe flesh it out in a little bit more detail.
Keep doing that because it's important. It affects all of us and all of our families as we live longer. This is part of our future, and what Dr. Power and so many of his colleagues are now trying to do, people like Robin, is help us live better, longer, and we're learning how to do that. So you can meet him tonight. Thanks for being here, Dr. Power.
Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Tim George, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you enjoy this Tuesday afternoon, and we're back with you tomorrow on Member-Supported Public Radio.